When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet, but I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Love this podcast because it crushes your dreams of getting rich quick.
They actually got me into reading stats for anything.
You're tuned in to the Investing for Beginners podcast.
Led by Andrew Sather and Dave Ahern.
Step-by-step premium investing guidance for beginners.
Your path to financial freedom starts now.
Starts now.
All right, folks, welcome to Investing for Beginners podcast. Today we have episode 343. Today we're going to answer some fantastic listener questions we got recently. With that, if you have any questions, you can send them to newsletter@einvestingforbeginners.com. You can also reach out to us on Spotify. They have a place where you can ask questions at the bottom of each show, or you can reach out to me at on Twitter or X at IFB_podcast. And we'll go ahead and read the questions on the air for you. So with that, let's go ahead and dive into the first question. So this is from Nocturne. Hello, I'm a new viewer and really liked your podcast. I wanted to know how I should be investing in an ETF. Do I just put money over time or wait till there's a price drop to invest? So a great question about ETFs. Andrew, do you want to take a first swing at this?
My vote is to put money over time. What's your vote?
My vote is to put money over time.
Yeah.
How would we say that? Well, I guess, first of all, what's an ETF?
Yeah, ETF, if you're a first-time listener, it's basically a way to buy a basket of stocks. Some of the most popular ETFs are ones like ticker SPY, and that gives you the S&P 500. It buys a basket of the S&P 500 stocks, so instead of having to buy them individually, you can buy the ETF, and it holds all of those for you. And so there's a very good reason why you would not want to buy those waiting for the price drop to happen, because I have no idea when the price is going to drop, and Dave has no idea, and your neighbor down the street has no idea, and your stockbroker has no idea. Nobody has any good idea of when the stuff's going to drop and when it's going to go up. The only things we can know is over the very long term, stocks have a good price appreciation because they grow alongside the economy. And that's pretty much all we've got.
Yeah, that's true. We don't really have any way of predicting when the prices are going to go up or down. And one of our favorite strategies is to use a process called dollar cost averaging, where you put a regular amount of money into the stock market at a regular intervals. So just for easy numbers, you take $100 and you put it in the stock market every first Tuesday of every month. And by doing that, you kind of avoid the trying to air quote time the market and wait till there's a better price, because you're just buying whatever price it's offering for you at that particular time. And most 401ks, I would probably hazard to say all 401ks, this is exactly what they do. You decide on an allocation, whatever that may be, and then the money is taken from your paycheck and given to the brokerage that manages the ETF for you or the 401k for you at your job, and then they buy that particular basket of stocks. And it's a time-proven, well-worn process, and it works really well, and it takes the the thing I like about it, it takes the thinking out of it. You don't have to stress about, okay, should I wait for the price to go down? Should I buy on Wednesday instead of Tuesday? It sets a habit and it starts you getting invested. And it's not necessarily a set it and forget it, but it's certainly more so than buying Amazon or Nvidia, for example. So it can be a fantastic way to invest. And for most people, it's the best way to invest because, as Andrew said, it's a basket of stocks. You don't have to stress about the individuality of like, am I picking this one or is this one bad or this one good? You're just buying all of them and then you let somebody else do all the heavy lifting and all the work.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. All right. So hopefully we answered that question adequately. So let's move on to the next one. So this one is, Dear Andrew and Dave, first off, I want to thank both of you for creating the Investing for Beginners podcast. I'm 30 years old and finally wanted to get into investing after landing a salary position as an assistant superintendent in golf. Cool job. All of their podcasts seem to be running on caffeine and market mover news. So thanks for pumping the brakes and shining a light on air quote boring value investing. As I start to build my portfolio, I have a high concentration on undervalued securities. The market is somewhat shunned, but still pay an impressive dividend, as well as the Dividend Aristocrats and Kings. My question is, and I'm sure the answer is obvious, what if you purchase a stock for a deal slash steal, but the price starts running away from you and the comfort you're willing to pay for a second or third position goes out the window? Do you keep purchasing that stock at a premium or build up positions elsewhere in the portfolio? Thank you again. I've binged to episode 100 and can't wait for the COVID episodes. And this is from Ryan. So fantastic question, Ryan. Thank you for sending that in. And congrats on the new gig. That sounds like a lot of fun. And hopefully you get to play a lot of golf. So Andrew, you want to go ahead and kind of help Ryan figure out this perplexing problem?
It is a perplexing problem. And there's probably no good universal answer for it. You know, you wonder if every investor might answer this slightly differently. And you have very good investors who are very smart and do very well. And some might answer one way and some might answer the other way. So I don't think there's particularly a right answer here. And it really depends on what you're trying to achieve. And to me, I think it would depend on the stock itself as well. Like, what kind of a company are we talking about? If I had to answer for myself, I would probably say, I guess because my track record shows, once the price starts running away, then I'm pretty much, you know, used up that opportunity and move on to looking for the next one. But that doesn't mean that that's the best thing to do at all times. So I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Well, I'm trying to approach it in a different way. So my normal reaction or my normal methodology is to look for a company that is, you know, going the other way price-wise. And so if it's a great company and I can buy it on a deal, I prefer to do that. And so when I'm trying to buy companies that I already own in the portfolio, I generally look for that in my process. But one of the things that I've been trying to learn how to do is average up as opposed to averaging down. I think it's natural for most investors and probably very common for most value investors to average down. So it's easy when the stock market, the tide goes out and everything drops, it's real easy to buy then because you feel like you're getting a good deal on your socks or your stocks. But averaging up, it's a lot harder thing to do. And so, for example, with Microsoft, I bought it for the first time in 2014 at like $33, $34 a share. And then I bought it again maybe 4 or 5 years ago at around $120 a share. And then I bought it again at $240. And now I'm considering buying some more. But along the way, I got some advice from Brian Feraldi and some others that you should figure out the valuation now as opposed to comparing it to the anchoring of the price that you originally bought it for. Because if it's still undervalued, even though it's 2 or 3, 4 times the price that you originally bought it at, it's still a good deal. And that psychologically is hard for me to do, I'll admit, but it's something that I've been trying to make a more conscious effort to look at when I'm trying to reinvest in my portfolio as opposed to gathering new positions. And so that's something I've been trying to do. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, I was going to tell a similar story, so I'm glad you told a better one because that's such a great it's such a great example and such extremes, right? I mean,
right.
Going from 33 to 200 and something.
Right.
And I did something similar. And it's because the business itself actually grew that much and became that profitable, which is astonishing and doesn't happen every day, obviously, but for certain businesses, it does play out that way. And you do get situations where a stock might be just as attractive as when you first bought it, even though it's up 50%, or it could even be an even better deal, even though it's up 100%. It really depends on the underlying business.
Right. Exactly. So what are your thoughts on buying it at a premium? Like, is there ever a situation where you would pay, you know, if you normally buy the company at 25 or 35 times earnings, would you ever pay 70 or 80, you know, just because you want to own more of that particular company?
Yeah, definitely never to that extreme. But I do, and this isn't like a hard science. I don't have like strict buckets where I'm putting these stocks into. But in my context with a portfolio of 25-ish names, I do have stocks that I'm more willing to pay a premium with and other stocks where I'm not able to put a premium on. I'm not willing to put a premium on, period. And that doesn't have like some hard science behind it. It's really a company like Microsoft. I feel I understand why it's going to grow at a higher rate than most businesses. And so I understand why it should do it. It also has had the track record to show it can do it. And so I'm more willing to pay a premium on a company like that rather than something that maybe is a little more cyclical or more of like a buybacks machine that once the price runs up, you don't get Microsoft type growth from this kind of company. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how I try to look at it, in that like certain businesses, you do allow the exception to pay more of a premium than a different business. And it really depends on what the market's showing you at any given point in time. And you just kind of have to, it's a never ending balancing act because everything changes so fast. Do you have a long-term mindset searching for safe compounders? So am I. And I'm investing my entire life savings with the picks from ValueSpotlight.com.
When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet, but I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card worth more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. Budgeting was always a challenge for me. I struggled to find the best way to keep track of all of my money, not to mention all the time tracking down receipts, cataloging expenses, and trying to figure out what went wrong with my air quote system until Monarch Money. Monarch Money allowed me to easily see what is going on with my finances, helping me get a better handle on my spending, budgets, and more. It's my go-to app every day, more so than my bank, because I can quickly see where I am with my budgets and spending, allowing me to invest more and spend time on the things that I want to do. It's my GPS for money. Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all of your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. Create custom budgets, set goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/beginners. Unlike other personal finance apps, Monarch's simple, intuitive design makes it so easy to set up, customize, and use. Monarch has built-in features to collaborate with your partner, family, or financial advisor. Invite them to your account at no extra cost, and they'll get their own login info and a joint view of all of your finances. Monarch is the most customizable budgeting app. Change the layout of your dashboard, toggle between light and dark mode, create custom budgets and notifications, set up automatic rules for transactions and notifications, and more. In fact, Monarch Money is one of the first to bring you direct Apple Card, Apple Cash, and savings syncing with the latest iOS 17.4 update. Now you can sync your wallet directly for seamless budgeting. After trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it's a top-rated personal finance app. And right now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/beginners. That's monarchmoney.com/beginners for your extended 30-day free trial. Yeah, it really does. I would never pay. I kind of try to look at it kind of like you're doing, where you're looking at it on individual case-by-case basis. So I will be willing to pay a higher premium for a company like Visa because I know it really well, and I feel like their earnings are maybe more valuable than, let's say, JP Morgan's. Right. And so it's also kind of not necessarily an apples to apples comparison either. So even though they're both in the financial industry, you would never equate JP Morgan's business model with Visa's. And a bank generally has lower valuations because it's just a different kind of beast. And the market generally values their earnings lower than they would a company like Visa. And so I would have to treat that differently. Like if you're looking at JP Morgan and they're trading at normally just a 14 PE and all of a sudden it's at a 25, I don't know that I would go that far on them. But if Visa is trading at a 28 and it goes to 36, I might be willing to pull the trigger on that because I feel like that risk is worth the reward, where I wouldn't feel like that with JP Morgan, I guess.
I'm 100% with you. And I love to camp out here for a second because I own both companies. And so the context behind this is my belief, and everybody has a narrative for every valuation in every stock, right? So here's my narrative. My narrative is that JP Morgan's upside is more limited because you have regulatory issues. They are already the biggest bank in the United States. And then those regulatory issues keep them from being able to buy back a bunch of stock because they have to keep, just the nature of banks, you have to keep a certain amount in reserves. Now that can change in the future, but that's how it is right now. And so they have really nice, consistent, steady growth that if you pay the right price for it, it can make double-digit returns for your portfolio. Visa, on the other hand, I had a post I did for Value Spotlight subscribers a couple months ago, I think, using data that you had sent over to me, Dave, about the value of checks, the value of payments that's still being done through check versus card. And so the available TAM that Visa still has looks like it can be very, very high still and support really high revenue growth as the company has earned. And so you have two reasons to kind of think this narrative through. One is if you look at the history of the recent history of Visa and JP Morgan, you say, wow, Visa's grown a lot faster than JP Morgan. Okay, that could deserve a higher valuation. And then the second part is everything we just described, where the future upside from all the information we could gather appears to be in Visa's favor of JP Morgan. And so because of those things and the power and magic and beauty of compounding at higher growth rates, that's why I believe that those stocks trade at those different valuations. And it's also why I would be more willing to pay a premium on the Visa thing, not because the market's paying a higher multiple for it, but because I believe that their upside and their longevity demands, and my comfort with understanding why their moat allows for that longevity, allows me the comfort to pick a stock at a premium like that.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. And, you know, Andrew's right. There is, everybody has a different narrative when you talk about valuation. And even though we're using terminology like PE ratio, which is price over earnings, that's a very common terminology to use to value companies when you're talking. I generally try to use a lot more involved methods to value the company, but using a PE ratio is an easy shorthand to talk about it amongst friends, if you will.
Yes.
If I tried to talk to you about the DCF valuation for Visa versus a valuation model for JP Morgan, you guys would all be falling asleep at the car. So we don't want any of that.
Yeah. I do lots of things I liked about the question, Ryan. I liked he talked about the dividend aristocrats and the dividend kings. And it does feel like some of those maybe haven't gotten as much love lately. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can describe what those are and why those are potentially attractive for people.
Yes. Okay. So dividend aristocrats are a group of stocks that have paid a growing dividend for 25 years or more. They also have to be a certain size of market cap, and they also have to be part of the S&P 500, I believe. And I'm not sure about that third one.
I'm not sure either.
Truthfully. But I know they have to pay a dividend for 25 years, and they have to be a certain size of company. So it can't be like a $500 million market cap. It's got to be a fairly larger company. dividend kings are basically an extension of that. So dividend aristocrats can also be dividend kings. And dividend kings are companies that have paid a growing dividend for 50 years or more. And so aristocrats can be kings, but kings can't necessarily be aristocrats. So those are a lot of income investors. I love dividend aristocrats. And there's a basket of around, the last I remember counting was 66 dividend aristocrats. I'm not sure about the kings, but they're very generally very solid, stable companies. If I tell you some of the names, you'd be like, oh yeah, okay. Like Johnson & Johnson, for example, is probably the perfect use case of the dividend aristocrat. It's a growing company. It's not a fast grower like an NVIDIA, but it pays, you know, a growing dividend, and it's a great, they actually buy back a lot of shares too. So it's a very income friendly investment, but they also tend to be air quote boring companies. So you're not going to see a lot of tech in the dividend aristocrat space, at least not at this point. Maybe in 10 years, you'll see more of them. NVIDIA actually does pay a dividend, may shock some people, but that's what I know about those.
So would you say, you know, you mentioned the income investor, would you say the attractiveness of a dividend, take your typical or average dividend aristocrat or dividend keen, the attractiveness of that depends on your goals as an investor?
Yeah, definitely. Some of them are going to probably grow about as fast as the economy. So your share appreciation is not going to be as great as investing in Apple, for example. But the total return you would get from these kinds of investments would be probably maybe a third from the dividends, maybe a third from buybacks, and maybe a third from share appreciation. So it may grow like 3% a year revenue-wise, and it may pay a dividend of 3.5%, and it may have a 2.5% dividend or a share buyback yield. And so that would give you an 8 or 9% return, which is nothing to sneeze at by any stretch. But they get shunned because they're not shiny. They don't get a lot of press. And like I said, the majority of them are under the radar kinds of companies that just you don't hear a lot of people talk about unless there's some sort of tragedy or some really bad news that happens with the company. They definitely fly under the radar.
Yeah, for sure. I would like one of those, but raise the 3 to 5.
All right. Yeah. That all day long. Yeah, exactly. But because of their stable nature and their stable growth of paying a growing dividend, that's what makes them attractive to income investors. So people that are trying to build up a portfolio that will pay them growing dividends as they get closer to retirement or are in retirement. And so that can be very, very attractive for those kinds of investors. And they're not super volatile. You can generally sleep pretty well at night owning these kinds of companies too.
So I guess, what is it about the businesses themselves that gives them this characteristic in your view?
I think as a general rule, they have proven, you know, 25 years in business growing a dividend. That means that they have created or produced a product or service that people find valuable for a very long period of time. And it also means that management does a good job of operating the business so they can generate lots of free cash flow, because that's where the dividends come from. So if a company isn't generating cash flow, it doesn't have the wherewithal to pay a growing dividend. And so a company like a dividend aristocrat, you know, Pepsi, Coca-Cola, Johnson & Johnson, these are businesses that have been around for a very long time, and they're very efficient. They do what they do very well. People like their products a lot and use them regularly. And so that allows them to be efficient with the revenues that they generate. They don't waste a lot of it, and it becomes free cash flow, which they can use for dividends, growing the dividend, or they can buy back shares. Because a lot of times they generally don't have tons of reinvestment opportunities like Microsoft does, for example. So it just lends itself more to being something that they would pay out as a dividend instead of just building up cash on their balance sheet.
What's the best way to get started in the market? Download Andrew's ebook for free at stockmarketpdf.com.
I'm Richard Serrett. Join me on Strange Planet for in-depth conversations with the world's top paranormal investigators, alien abductees, Bigfoot trackers, monster hunters, time travelers, alternative archaeologists, remote viewers, and more.
As I was on the way to Area 51, I was stopping on the side of the road and just taking measurements, and I found this one spot where time slowed down by a fraction of a second. It's not supposed to do that.
from the two big categories, animal mutilations and human abductions. You have to conclude that genetic material is being harvested.
Well, I reached for a rifle, and I turned and looked, and it was already moving away, and it was descending the bluff. There's no way any human could have went down it. It was probably a 75-degree angle straight down, almost.
On Richard Serrett's Strange Planet, we're redefining reality. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Do not go any further. Turn around. Go home.
Have you ever wondered why we call French fries French fries? Or why something is the greatest thing since sliced bread? There are answers to those questions. Everything Everywhere Daily is a podcast for curious people who want to learn more about the world around them. Every day, you'll learn something new about things you never knew you didn't know. Subjects include history, science, geography, mathematics, and culture. If you're a curious person and want to learn more about the world you live in, just subscribe to Everything Everywhere Daily wherever you cast your pod.
Right. Are there any red flags you'd look at for when sifting through these kinds of companies?
I think there's probably two things that really spring to mind. Number one would be a unsustainable dividend. If you see a ratio called a dividend payout ratio, where you basically compare the dividends to the earnings of the company, and if it's over 100%, that's not sustainable because you can't pay out more than you make, right? Just like we can't pay out more than we make. And it's the same thing with a business. Now, they can do it short term if they're borrowing money and things of that nature, but that, again, that's not sustainable. So generally, when you see companies that have a really high payout ratio, that could lead to some problems depending on, you know, if there's upheavals in their business or their business model gets disrupted, or we go through an economic calamity like we had during COVID. Those can all put a lot of strain and stress on those dividend payments. So that's one thing. And then the other thing would be if the dividend yield is really, really high, generally that's not a good thing either, because the higher the dividend yield, that means that there's something going on with the price of the stock. And that is probably not desirable. So generally, depending on what kinds of company it is, a REIT, for example, a real estate investment trust, they have to pay out the majority of their income as a dividend. So they generally have very high dividend yields. But a company like Johnson & Johnson or Coke, their dividend yields will sit in the 2, 3, 4% range, and that's pretty normal for them. So if you see that shoot up to like 8 or 9%, that's a red flag. Yeah.
Have you found a unicorn like that yet?
Not yet. Like, I'm still looking. I'm still looking. I'm still looking.
What was GameStop at way back in the day?
Oh, God. I think at one point it was 8, 10, 11% yield, dividend yield or something like that. It was ridiculously high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Too funny.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, never say never. Maybe one day.
Maybe one day Apple 10%. Will be a dividend aristocrat, right?
Yeah. Maybe one day interest rates go high enough, then that'd be a different world.
Yes, it would be. All right. So let's move on to the last question. So we got, NVIDIA is the hottest and trendy buy these days. What are your thoughts on the company? I can't seem to figure out what are the recent events that caused the continuous ups of the stock. This is a great question. So this is from Leslie. Andrew, I'm going to let you take first stab at this.
Yeah, thanks for writing in, Leslie. I don't own NVIDIA. I've been looking at it here and there. I do have some positions in semiconductor companies, and so I have a basic understanding of some of the technology, and also I have positions in Microsoft, so I'm very invested in the cloud. And that's basically what NVIDIA does, right? They make these semiconductors that go into data centers and servers, and that's a very booming industry at the moment. What I understand about their tech, if you look at their investor relations, you can go on their investor relations, you can look at their earnings slides and see visualizations of it. And I think that's kind of helpful. If you're not very techie, at least you get a visual understanding of what's going on. But I think it's fascinating. They used to make these GPU chips, and it used to be mostly for gaming and then like very specific computer applications. And now whatever advancements they made in that technology has now, they've been able to fully utilize to put in these data centers, and some weird mix of the software and the hardware has enabled NVIDIA to be the leader in basically making computing power happen at the highest levels. Mm-hmm. And so that's why it's a nice story. But then also, if you look at their earnings, I think it was like in 1 year, their earnings in the next year was higher than their revenue the previous year, which is like unheard of, absolutely right. insane. And so that's my understanding of the story right now. And obviously everybody's huge in the AI. Curious your thoughts.
Well, I agree with everything you were saying. I think it really stems from the fact that the tech that they've created and the stack, the data center stacks that they've created have really enabled OpenAI, Microsoft, Google, and some of these others to really accelerate their usage of AI. And that is really driving the majority of what's going on with NVIDIA, as it really comes back to, you know, this technology that they created, you know, decades ago has found a much broader use than what it was originally intended for. And they have also been working really hard to create, you know, the cutting edge of servers and data stacks and, you know, these farms that, you know, people are buying, you know, hundreds of these things at tens of millions of dollars to create, you know, data servers that they can, you know, Meta compete with Google for AI, because that's where the cutting edge is right now, is AI. And that's where really where the fire is. That's where everybody's moving towards right now and trying to compete to, I guess the way I try to envision it is trying to position themselves in a land grab, to position themselves so once things start to settle out, so to speak, that there will be three or four winners in that space. And NVIDIA is right now the place you need to go to get the best tech to compete with the other ones that have already bought the best tech. And so that's where NVIDIA is really, you know, hopping on this bandwagon. It's what's kind of amusing to me a little bit is that it just shows the people don't know much about the history of the stock market. NVIDIA has been around forever. It's like been around for 40 years. And it, like I said, it pays a dividend. That's very unusual for a tech company, but it hasn't been a cutting edge, leading edge company for, you know, very long time. The GPUs obviously were very cutting edge, but it, like you said, it was very niche specific to gaming and things of that nature. And now it's become the hottest thing in tech, but it's not a brand new company. They didn't just IPO like 2 years ago. It's been around for a long, long time.
Yeah, it's part of the fascination behind it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we haven't seen something this crazy from a big tech company maybe since Microsoft mm-hmm. in the cloud.
Right.
Or maybe Amazon in their cloud. I don't know. I mean,
frankly, I think those pale to what NVIDIA has been doing. You know, like you said,
right.
You know, to grow from having, you know, the earnings being bigger than the revenue was the year before, you know, kind of thing. I don't think Amazon or Microsoft were doing that. So it's just, no. Yeah, those are big boy numbers.
Yeah. So you feel like investors should be looking at a stock like this? What's your take on that?
Boy, you know, that's the $24 question, right? The two things that you hear everybody bandy about, at least on social media, is number one, it's a can't miss company. But the flip side of it is you get a lot of raging debate on whether it's too expensive or it's reasonably priced. And that seems to be nobody questions the product that they're selling. I think the biggest issue is whether the demand will continue and how long it'll continue and what is a good price to pay for buying it now. You know, when you bought it, you know, there's a lot of people on social media doing victory laps because they bought it a year ago and now it's up, you know, I don't know. I don't even know how much it's up. It's huge. And it's the second or third largest company in the world now, right now, but who knows how long that's going to last. And so that's the question is that, did you miss the boat? Or can you still hop on that train? Is there still, you know, a lot of track left to run? I don't know the answer to that because I have not, other than reading some periphery stuff about the company, I'm by no means an expert.
Yeah. I feel like for me, it at the moment falls outside of what I'm comfortable with, but I reserve the right to change my mind in the future.
Right.
I have two conflicting thoughts on it. So the first is everybody had problems with the valuation of Facebook mm-hmm. and Google and Amazon for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. And the investors who did not listen to that were paid very, very handsomely. Mm-hmm. You also have a company like Intel, which is a good kind of parallel, because back in Intel's heyday, they kind of had like what NVIDIA has now, this kind of monopoly on the leading edge of a big technology. And a lot of investors made a ton of money for very many years buying Intel. So that's like, that's one side, right? And then on the other side, you have like the pessimist, I guess, in me that says, you know, be careful, reversion to the mean, and all of that. And I guess along the lines of like looking at hottest and trendiest stocks and wondering like, am I going to be able to keep up if I don't have these in my portfolio? I think there's a decent chance NVIDIA could be like a Facebook, Google, or, you know, Amazon. But I also think there's a pretty good chance it won't be. And so the question you have to ask yourself is that the game that you want to play? Mm-hmm. And so what I found comforting that I stumbled across in a book that I was reading, it's called The Drunkard's Walk. It talks about why, yeah, funny name, right?
Yeah.
It's talking about randomness and its effect on our lives. But he talked about why reversion to the mean is an innate part of our physical reality. Because if reversion to the mean does not exist for something, then that something grows out of control. So take human height as an example. If there was no reversion to the mean in human height, then every tall person would have a taller offspring, would have a taller offspring, would have offspring
that
couldn't fit on the earth, right?
Right.
And so you have reversion to the mean instead, where the heights of each generation kind of change. And you do get some variation that's kind of close to that mean, that average, but it fluctuates up and down from that. And so if we see that with human beings, we see that with trees, we see that with so many things on this planet, I think for our investment portfolios, we can feel safe that there is that as a constant force. And so because there is enough reversion to the mean, you don't have to be buying all the hottest and trendiest stocks. Some of them, yes, you're going to wish you bought. A lot of them, you're going to be glad you didn't. And it's because of reversion to the mean. And you can believe that reversion to the mean is going to happen because you see it in our daily life every single day.
Yeah, that's very well said. And I think that's one of the, probably the best way to think about this is that the likelihood that it goes on to become the next Amazon, Google, Microsoft are those, you have to balance that with Andrew was saying with the reversion to the mean and the likelihood of that. And I would probably hazard to say that the reversion to mean is probably more likely than the other. And so that's how I would bet on it. The other way that I would look at it is trying to look at maybe backing away from NVIDIA and maybe looking at some of the value chain around NVIDIA. So a company that I own that I'm familiar with is Taiwan Semiconductor, and that's a company that physically makes the chips that NVIDIA uses for their data centers. And so that would be a way that maybe you could take advantage of the demand that NVIDIA is seeing without having maybe to take on as much risk of investing in NVIDIA. And that's the way that I have chosen to play this game, if you will, is by investing in a company like Taiwan Semiconductor to help me mitigate the risk of maybe missing out on NVIDIA, but still being able to partake in the growing demand in AI, because Taiwan Semiconductor does is build those leading edge chips. And so that's, and there's a lot of demand for them. And so that can be a safer way to play it, but there's other opportunities as well.
Yeah, I love that. There are so many opportunities with every trend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love the TSMC thing too. How can I forget?
Yeah, right. Right. But to me, it's more like it's not really, but it kind of is more like the picks and shovels of what NVIDIA is doing. And so to me, that feels like a safer way to go. But, you know, that also means that I could be taking the risk of underperforming, like Andrew was saying earlier, that if you don't invest in NVIDIA, you may struggle to keep up with the market. But I'm trying to play a long-term game. And so my bet is that NVIDIA will slow down and cool off at some point, whereas Taiwan Semiconductor will be more like the tortoise and just kind of keep grinding on, and you can win that way too.
Yeah. And you know, if you're wrong about the NVIDIA thing, but you're right about the next three hot and trendy things that phase out, then you still win in that scenario.
Right.
Because this is a very long game.
Yes. Yes, it is. And you know, the last thing I'll throw out there is you don't have to invest in everything. Just because it's the hottest thing doesn't mean you have to invest in it. You can pass and still do great in the stock market. If you, you know, if you go back to our mentor, Warren Buffett, he's never really invested in the hottest thing. Apple was probably the closest thing he's ever invested in that was the air quote hottest thing. And it was kind of out of favor when he bought it. So it you don't have to do that to, you don't have to play the hottest thing game to be successful in the stock market.
Perfect.
Okay. All right. All right, folks. Well, with that, we will go ahead and wrap up our conversation for today. Thank everyone for taking the time to send us those fantastic questions. Please keep them coming. Newsletter at einvestingforbeginners.com, Twitter at IFB_podcast, or you can do them on Spotify as well. So with that, we'll go ahead and wrap us off. You guys go out there and invest with a margin of safety, emphasis on the safety. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you all next week.
We hope you enjoyed this content. 7 Steps to Understanding the Stock Market shows you precisely how to break down the numbers in an engaging and readable way with real-life examples. Get access today at stockmarketpdf.com. Until next time, have a prosperous day.
The information contained is for general information and educational purposes only. It is not intended for a substitute for legal, commercial, and/or financial advice from a licensed professional. Review our full disclaimer at einvestingforbeginners.com.